suggest we don't try and look all these up because I'm going to be all over the place, but some words concerning human cultures. Genesis 2, verse 18. The Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone." A selection of verses from Genesis 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As the people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens." And skipping on a bit, the Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Psalm 106:35, "But they mingled with the nations and adopted their customs." Mark 7:13, and this is Jesus speaking to the teachers of the law. "You nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down." 2 Timothy 3:14, "Continue in the things you have learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you have learned them." Colossians 2:8, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." And finally, Revelation 7:9, "After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" Well, I wonder, do the young people in your life insist on greeting you with a fist bump? My kids, for the longest time, tried to greet me with a fist bump, and because I wouldn't, it became an exercise for them, a challenge to try and catch me off guard and get me to do a fist bump. The problem was I had my father in my head, who would dismiss anything that came from America, apart from jazz, that is. "It's an Americanism," he would declare. "Americans check things out, we check them." Well, I did research fist bumps, and I think they came first from boxing at the beginning of a bout, because you can't very well shake hands, so the referee invites two competing boxers to touch gloves. And then I think it is likely that after that it did come through the American basketball scene. My apologies, by the way, to any Americans. Ironically, the COVID pandemic meant that people all over the world were fist bumping and elbow bumping and whatever it may be, which does go to show that under certain pressures, culture changes. I'm hoping we can take a look at a 3-minute film now about the way people around the world greet one another. Thank you, Gareth. Well, very often the first contact we have with someone from another culture will be a greeting, won't it? And which greeting we use may be decided on where we are as we make the greeting. Everyone has some form of greeting, even if it's only the northern nod of a head and the less than sincere, "All right." It's important not to confuse high culture with culture in general. So high culture, we might think in terms of, I don't know, the opera and classical music and ballet, all of course which make up part of culture. But we're concerned today with things that everybody do, not just an educated elite. At its most basic level, the definition of culture is the patterned way that people do things together. So, patterned way people do things together. Now, we will come back to those as we go through what I'm going to call 6 features of culture. And the first of those features is that culture is ordered. Now, don't get too excited. I've got a one-minute video for you now of some road traffic. So, thank you. Thank you. Well, the title of that video is given as Crazy Indian Traffic. But I read an account of a foreigner in India recently who, fresh off the plane, saw a situation whereby a truck almost hit a young man on a moped, and he, working on the basis that the moped was more vulnerable, the foreigner joined in by accusing the lorry driver of driving badly, but later learned and reflected that there are indeed rules, but in this instance it would be the bigger vehicle takes precedence, and those were the rules that the traffic was operating on. So my point is that to an outsider, another culture may appear chaotic, but that all cultures are in some way ordered. And the ordering of a culture is in relation to that other word we sometimes hear, which is worldview. It's sometimes described as being like a game of chess. I think this one, taking place in Hong Kong as it happens. Culture is the things you can see, such as if you were watching two people play chess. But if you don't know the rules of chess, what you have is just people moving things around. Maybe you'd say, well, that looks a bit like a horse, it looks a bit like a castle. But it appears to be random. But to know the rules of chess is to understand at a deeper level why it is that the people are making the moves that they make. Another way of looking at it is that each culture is an answer to deep questions, and the questions themselves come from the way that we see the world. So the questions, the worldview, are invisible to the onlooker, but what we can see are the answers that that group of people arrives at. They arrive at it in their culture that is visible. We might think about worldview as a mental map each group or society has for the way that it understands the world. So what a group thinks about God and good and evil, about what's beauty and what is ugly, about what is male and what is female. Now, an example of this, the changing worldview of so many people in Western societies in recent decades, it's just been phenomenal. So until 15, 20 years ago, it would have been completely obvious to just about anyone what a man is and what a woman is. But we'll watch a four-minute video now, some of us will have seen before, which shows how doubts about male and female, gender and identity, have played out, in this case among some American students, but you might remember this has been a debate in the UK also. And as it happens, it was just around which bathrooms people would use, whether they should be gender neutral or not. If we could watch that video, please, Gareth. I should just say I don't personally have any strong opinions or views about bathrooms. My point is the deepest held assumptions about what a man is and what a woman is bound to shape what we see occurring in culture, in relation, in this case, to men and women. In this case, all that an onlooker sees is that either men and women use the same toilets, public toilets, or they don't. But that is a cultural expression, a very deep, fundamental questions and how they are answered. What society decides about that flows from what men and women understand themselves to be. Do they exist at all, male and female, or is it just something that human beings have imagined, and so we are free to imagine differently? So on the slide, beginning at the top, if in our worldview God exists, what is the character of God? What, if any, is the relationship of God to human beings? Then to the right in the image, what any given society thinks about good or evil, why people do what we see them doing in any given place relates to those central ideas. Here's another graphic. What we assume about men and women will play out in the top one there. What, if anything, makes for a marriage? Is it plausible I can marry my goat, my dog, my cat? Well, not if my worldview can't conceive of it. But if our worldview is so shaped, then perhaps it's possible. Then clockwise on the image, at the time of birth, Is that something to be celebrated? Is the new life sacrosanct or not? If there's a God, do we thank God for that birth? Moving clockwise, what do we do at the time of death? Is it a time to appease ancestors or seek God, or is it just meaningless? At times of harvest and planting, are they times to seek the ancestors' help, to seek God, or are they merely physical matters of mass production and so really just a matter for agricultural science? In times of sickness, is the problem that someone has put a curse on me and so I must seek the help of a traditional healer to address it? Or is it that my body is just a machine which is not functioning and therefore we refer to science to deal with it? Or is it perhaps karma? A second aspect of culture is that it's what we do in groups. It is social. God said to Adam, it is not good for man to be alone. And God defined human beings as social as he did so. And culture is the way that we order our social lives. It's been said that to isolate someone from the culture is a kind of murder. The former US senator, presidential candidate John McCain, talked about his experience of isolation in a prisoner of war camp. It's an awful thing, he said. It crushes your spirit. It weakens your resistance more effectively than any other form of mistreatment. Similarly, Nelson Mandela remembered solitary confinement as the most forbidding aspect of prison life. There is no end and no beginning. There is only one's mind which can begin to play tricks. Others describe it as a perpetual state of living death, isolated from meaningful social exchange. Our culture is so important then. It gives us a sense of identity and purpose to the extent we feel a kind of death if it's taken from us. Think about our next aspect of culture. We're going to work with the person next to us in twos or threes. Social anthropologists, so those who are concerned to study cultures, they place a lot of importance on proverbs. So, for example, when I was growing up, I would hear it said that a stitch in time saves nine. So, for those who don't know the proverb, if my shirt starts to fall apart, one stitch breaks, I can either choose to repair it immediately or leave it, and I will have nine stitches necessary to repair it. But they say something deeper about the culture, that there's a value in doing things ahead of time rather than leaving them to unravel. I heard one in Mozambique that was, the goat eats where it is tethered. That was taken to mean it's kind of inevitable that people will take things from their workplace. So now, working with the person next to you, perhaps you could share a proverb that you would hear growing up, but then also, if you could explain to the person you're with what you think it means, what it was trying to convey. So, proverbs we learned growing up, and then what they were, what they say about the values that are behind the proverb. And yeah, just work in twos or threes, whatever works where you are. So the point of that is to show that, thirdly, culture is learned. Usually we don't realise that we're learning culture. It's not formal learning, is it? So I've realised my own children spent 10 years in a church which takes the Bible seriously, but they didn't realise that that was what was happening until two of them went to university. And only then they met those from other churches that prioritise something else or hold loosely to the Bible's teaching or even deny it. Only at that point, when they had to choose a church for themselves, they realised the culture which had formed them to that point. They had been inculcated into biblical Christianity without realizing that's what it was. So we learn our culture from the religious groups of which we're part, but also our families and from our peers. We learn it through family rituals, learn it through the stories that people tell. I referred earlier to the stories that my dad would tell about his wartime experiences, but importantly, the meaning given to those stories. Which brings us back to those gospel events from this morning and the place of interpretation. We learn culture through proverbs like the ones we've been sharing. And we may talk about other cultures, but often not be aware of our own culture because we, as it were, absorbed it with our mother's milk. If you want to know what water is, don't ask a fish. It has no experience of something else, no way to convey what it means to have come from the background that it had. Well, what I hope for us this weekend will be that we reminded, as we come to our own Christian discipleship and as we think of our own local church, there are other influences that may or may not fit well with a biblical worldview that we are given, and we will come back to that. But for now, number four is culture is also a result of human achievement. There are some of those verses I read at the beginning concerning baking bricks. Culture is a secondary environment imposed by humans on the natural environment. It is the work of human hands or minds. So we might consider a river, it would be there irrespective of human activity. It's from the natural environment, whereas canals are made by human minds and hands. They are the work of people together. Flintstone would be formed naturally, whereas flintstone turned into an arrowhead is an artifact of culture. A baby crying is the same anywhere you go. It didn't have to be taught, but when a child speaks its first word, it has learned that pattern behavior of the people where he or she are situated, and so their culture. And human beings derive a great sense of pride and achievement from their culture. So we can experience very much deep emotions if our culture begins to break up. And perhaps something about that video earlier on bathrooms, you felt that visceral feeling in your stomach about what is happening to culture. If we think it's being diluted or destroyed by those who don't share our culture. So my wife, Bianca, was in a supermarket in London, and she was talking to her cousin, who is also Brazilian, and they were speaking their mother tongue, Portuguese, when a man passing by said, "Speak English!" Now, he may have been mentally unstable, but any of us can surprise ourselves with the depth of feeling around these issues of culture and identity. And now we're getting down to it, because culture is concerned with values. This is seen especially through rituals that affirm what is valued as good and what is rejected as evil. Now, I think it's true to say that in the UK now, in court, you simply have to declare that you will provide truthful evidence, and you have to affirm that. I think you can choose to do that without reference to God, but we will be familiar with the idea that using a Bible in a court of law, the idea swearing on a Bible affirms speaking the truth. That's due to Christian history. It's a cultural value, isn't it, that ostensibly at least the Bible is a way to reject lies and to call on a religious authority to authenticate it. So that tells you there's something about the application of Christian values in this culture, at least historically. And in fact, a study published by the British Journal of Psychology last year showed that even now, defendants in court may stand a better chance of avoiding a jail sentence if they make a biblical vow than if they don't make a non-religious vow. And finally, before we take a break, sixthly, a living culture as opposed to an ancient culture, any culture that exists now will go through change and adaptation. And the question that matters most for the Christian is, what direction is the culture changing towards? Things that can change that, I think we've seen recently in the pandemics, mass media changes that, social media, migration and immigration, urbanization, education and academia, the economy, and so on are all factors. I will write any questions there might be, but I think we'll leave it there in terms of what we'll say about culture for the moment.